Now it's time for me to introduce the speaker for tonight. A little background. I met this woman a little over 5 years ago. She had just moved here from Texas, and I thought she was crazy. I met her at meetings at first, and this woman knew her stuff. I knew that, but she hadn't lived here long, and one of the girls I knew in the program fell down in that horrible snowstorm and broke her leg. And she didn't hesitate to let this woman move in with her. I thought that was pretty crazy. The cool thing is now I realize it wasn't craziness, it was compassion. It was service. And I am so fortunate to know this woman. We've become very close over the last year. She's taught me, mostly I believe, about my own self-worth. She's taught me to believe in myself, and she's taught me about the importance of sponsorship in this program, and I will forever be grateful for her for what she's done for me over the last year especially. She's got an amazing story. I know pretty much all of it, but I haven't heard it actually officially done, but I know she's shared it in many, many places as a circuit speaker. With that being said, I'd like to introduce you to a woman I love immensely, Miss Tracy Medford.
My name is Tracy Medford, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Tracy.
And I have been given the gift of sobriety since April the 5th of 1985, and I'm extremely thankful for that. I was driving in, and somebody asked me on the way in, they were like, have you been here before? And I'm like, yep. It's about 1987, something like that. It's been quite a while. But I pulled in, and I had no idea where I was going because there's a lot that's changed since then. And I'm just like, I have no idea where to go. So, of course, I think I must have turned in before the main entrance because I never saw the main entrance. But there was somebody just walking, and I'm like rolling down my window. Is there a meeting around here somewhere? And they were like, yeah, you know, if you'll just park right there and then go over here, there should be a door on the side. And I thought, story of my life, man. I come in everywhere from like the side door, you know, someplace that I'm probably really not supposed to be. Exactly. So it is. It's good to be here. First time I moved to Georgia, I was 15 months sober. And stayed here for 6.5 years and Rebos. I think every now and then I still see people like kind of put their head down like they're kind of embarrassed for you if you went to Rebos. I don't know if that's still the case. But I loved Rebos, let me tell you. Although ironically, you know, I wish there were some of those old timers that were still left because I would go up to every one of them, I would hug their necks, and I would say, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Because I just, good gosh, if we could fight them on something, we did. You know, and I think back about their love and their patience, but also their smarts, man. Because while I may have been misguided at times, it was still always from a good place, so they used all of my youth and exuberance in ways to help, I believe, a lot of people without really letting me know that they had gotten me to go down that road, because if I knew it, I'd have turned around, you know. So I'm really, really grateful. Like I said, I lived at 6.5 years of sobriety, and somehow God saw that I needed to come back here. I was kind of like, I've been there, done that. I don't feel the need again. Because I left behind, you know, my 80-something-year-old mother and my, gosh, I guess at the time, 4-year-old granddaughter. And it was an extremely difficult circumstance. But I'm here, and God always will show his face and his love to me if I'll just get out of my way to be able to see it. I grew up in a small town in East Texas, Dangerfield, Texas. And, you know, our big joke was, Rodney Dangerfield didn't come from there, but we were a lot like him in the fact that we got no respect. I mean, we were, except for high school football. Let me tell you something, Texas, we do some football. I mean, our high school stadiums there are better than most states' college fields that I've seen. But we love football, and so we did really well with that. But, you know, I was the baby of three. My brother and sister were 15 and 17 years older than me. And so it was kind of like I was raised as an only child, which, you know, again, I think that if you're an only child, you want siblings, and if you had them, you wished you hadn't of, you know. So another story of my life, you know, I want something other than what I currently have. And, but again, you know, in fact, I was thinking a lot about this on my way over, because the guy that did the recording then, I came back a few years later, and he was, like, clearing out all his stuff or whatever. So he hands me this stack of cassettes about this tall. And they were all the same. They were of me giving a talk here or whatever. And I didn't think much about it. I will never listen to myself on tape. I sound ridiculous to me. And so I just put them away and didn't think anything about it. But then several years forward, my husband, my current one, I've had a few of those too, but my husband, he was going through a cabinet of some sort or whatever, and he found one of those cassettes. And so, unbeknownst to me, he listened to it, and he came back and he was like, "Wow, that was a little salty, Tracy." So I think maybe that means that I may have used some inappropriate language from behind the podium, which I'm glad to say I don't do that anymore. Because no matter what, I just figure, especially at a speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like, I don't know who's going to be here. I mean, you all could be in the program. You might be families of. You might be somebody just walked in because they want to see if this is some kind of place that they would want to send their child or their grandchild. You know, what are we all about? And I'd like to think that no matter what the circumstances, that I do whatever I can to make that a positive impression. So a little bit of change since then. But let's put it this way. Y'all had the Olympics after I left, right? So it's been so long ago. But again, so I grew up in East Texas. My parents, my dad worked at the same company for like 45 years. Him and my mom were married 56 years when he passed away. And they're consistent. And I am so not about anything, really. Again, people that I heard talk about after I came in here, like, "Oh my God, it was horrible. We had to move around a lot." And I'm going, I'd have given anything for that. I mean, I grew up in this town of 3,000 people, so to get away with something was like a massive accomplishment, right? I mean, it's just, it's difficult. And once you've been caught in a couple of things, you wouldn't mind a brand new set of people to con, you know what I mean? Like, start over again and do it better. So, no, we never went anywhere. In fact, my mama, she's still living in that house in Dangerfield, Texas. In fact, she just celebrated her 89th birthday, and I can't wait to see her in a couple of weeks, you know, still living in her home. And so, but anyway, I had my first drink at 12. It was kind of the best thing that ever happened to me. I was, it was my best friend's birthday party. In fact, her birthday party was my very first drink and my very last drink. It's all on the same day, just different years. I send out a happy birthday to her, and she's like, "Sorry, how about you?" like she's apologizing that I'm here, you know. 30-something years later, "I'm so sorry you're still having to be at AA." And anyway, so we go, and I have nothing. I mean, like, I have no experience whatsoever with alcohol, like, not at all. My parents didn't drink. They didn't smoke. They didn't cuss, except for my dad twice. Both times had to do with me, so I just figured I brought that out in men, which, really, there's a lot of men that would tell you I do, actually. Here's what I know, though. I know that alcoholism is a family illness. And I tell you how I really know that, because there was not one drop of alcohol in my home ever, nor will there ever be a drop of alcohol in my home. But my mom's, both of her parents were alcoholics. My dad had alcoholism in his family. And our home, on the inside of our home, like, if you knew what alcoholism was, you'd know that my family was affected by it. When my dad would get mad, he just wouldn't speak to anybody, myself or my mom. And that could go for days or weeks at a time. It just depended. And it didn't matter whether he was upset at, like, somebody at work or if it was me. It just didn't matter who he was upset at. He just didn't speak to anybody until whatever time frame was up. And, you know, I have had a lot of making right to the best of my ability to do with my mom, because I literally took her husband from her for just, I mean, combined, it's probably years that I took from her. And yet, I was so angry with the both of them. In fact, I'm pretty certain that my talk here would have sounded something like, they were horrible people, you know? I mean, because again, that was my perception. I blamed so much, more so on my mom probably, but I stole her husband for a considerable period of time. I didn't know anything about alcohol, so they got me a six-pack of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, and while I have come to understand that tastes bad when it's cold, it was warm, so it was the most disgusting thing I'd ever put in my mouth. And I still to this moment in time, just, like, I don't drink things that taste horrible. I mean, I just don't. And it's almost like somewhere inside of me was like this thing that was going, just persevere, persevere. Something great's gonna happen if you just persevere. And something great did happen. All of a sudden, my cares were no more. That's what I know. I know that I felt my shoulders drop, and I didn't even know they were up by my ears, right? And so, you know, I start doing that as often as I possibly can. I graduated from high school and went to college, and like my first massive accomplishment at college was filling up my little dorm refrigerator with all the beer or whatever that I could find, because it was kind of me going to my parents, you know, like you bought the fridge, but look at what's in it, you know. Not that I would have ever told them that it was there. So, I mean, I got a lot of pleasure out of things that nobody else ever really knew, you know. But it, again, you know, I can't stay in school. Drinking is a daily occurrence. There's a lot of other things that are happening. And yes, I've done my share of dabbling in the other stuff as well. But I'm also a big believer in traditions. And while this meeting is kind of open to all of it, most of the meetings I share at are AA. And although I've shared at some NA meetings, and I'm an addict when I go there, and I'm just an alcoholic when I go to a big but meeting. Although I will say the treatment center told me to introduce myself as an alcoholic and a drug addict at the meetings, but I had a loving member of Alcoholics Anonymous say, hey, just fit in with us, will you? Just fit in. We know you got a lot of problems. You know, alcohol and drugs probably are not the only ones, which they're not. So anyway, again, I'll share anything one-on-one. There's just nothing in my past today if it'll help somebody else. But I was doing a lot of other stuff, and a lot of my friends started getting into some serious trouble. I don't know when I left college. It's all kind of a blur. I black out. I did from the very first time that I drank. And I, honest to God, I don't know, at some point, I just know I wasn't going to school anymore, and at some point, heck, I may have stayed on one of your couches. I mean, I stayed on a lot of people's couches, right? I mean, I'm the person that does that. And so everywhere I go, I have more belongings than when I leave. Somehow, it gets easier, right, the longer you do that couch surfing, because by the time it's all over, I mean, you pick up your Walmart sack and you go, you know. And so at some point, I'm just doing that, and I'm bartending, which was the best gig ever in the early 80s, because, like, it was expected, really, that you drank. I mean, like, I would work in a bar later on for just a really short period of time in sobriety, and I was like, holy crap, I'm watching all these people, and they're getting fired if they get caught drinking, and I just feel this urge to be like, I'm so sorry, man. You know, this was where to be in the late 80s, at least. You know, the only thing I ever got told was, God, could you leave the top shelf alone? Just, you know, drink as much as you want out of everything else. But that's some pretty expensive stuff, Tracy. And so I did. And I got my first DWI. I had a customer, I used to say my attorney, like I had him on retainer or something, got me out of jail from that. But really, he was just a customer. In fact, I thought he was so kind. He took me to my DWI school. And so I thought he was just being kind to me, but actually he was going too. He was on his eighth. I was on my first. Like, I picked the right attorney, man, you know? And so, I mean, you know, he's just showing me the ropes, but okay. But it wasn't him. It was the DWI instructor that told me that it was a myth that you couldn't smell vodka. Like, I believed you when you told me that you couldn't smell it. So it wasn't my buddy, the alcoholic attorney, it was the DWI instructor that informed me of that. And again, if that's today, I'm probably in prison right now. Texas has a lot harder stance. In fact, my second DWI that I got in 1985 when I came to you, that one, I should have gone to jail. And potentially prison even, because they don't play, not at all. And so, but I got that, and again, you know what my big takeaway was? I gotta leave my car at the bar so that I don't go get in my car drunk and drive. That's my takeaway, right? Not, oh, maybe you shouldn't drink and drive. So I just left my car there, and I just, like, got rides everywhere I needed to go for, like, 2 weeks, and then that bar called me and said I needed to come get my car, or they were going to tow it. And so I went and got my car, and it was like, well, what do you expect me to do? I had to go get my car, you know? I mean, so I'm driving drunk again, and I, you know, I don't even see the consequences of any of that at all. I called my parents one day, and somehow I wound up in an apartment by myself. I do not know how that happened. I remember I called home and said I could use a bed, and so it was about 2 hours away. My dad drove in, and again, we weren't talking, and he banged on the door, and I eventually see, because what had happened was I was drinking when I made the call, and I thought, oh my God, I got to get sober, right? 2 hours, I'm going to go get sober before my dad gets here, and I passed out, and I don't know how long he had been knocking at that door, and I eventually heard it, and I went to the door and opened it, and we walked out to the truck, and we got my bed, and we probably set it up, if I know my dad. And then he turned around to leave, and I'm just looking at him, and he's standing there, and out of, like, the one side of his face that I could see, like, there's just this steady flow of tears coming out of his eyes. And I'm standing there thinking to myself, what's your problem? I mean, granted, I'm not living the life that I know that you would want me to live. But look, I'm not in your little small precious town of Dangerfield, you know, so like get over yourself, like that shouldn't matter. Because again, I was taught that perception is more important than reality, right? So while Dad may not speak to us in the house or whatever, we go up to church and he's saying hello. And that's that peace that is just running into such difficulty with me because I love my dad. I mean, I was, God, the typical daddy's girl or whatever, but I didn't realize until after I'd come into AA and started working some steps that, God, I had some serious resentment at him. And so that's what I'm standing there thinking. You know, if I'm hurting anybody, it's only me. I can stand here and tell you because I don't know how much of it I'll get into. I never know where these talks are going to go. You know, but I stand in front of you today, an alcoholic, but also the mother of an alcoholic. My son is 30 years old, and I have gone and picked up his 9-month-old baby and brought to my house because him and her mom were shooting heroin and weren't taking care of her. And I have gone and visited him in jails. And I was sitting in the courtroom the day that he got sentenced to prison. But I'm telling you, this program and these 12 steps and sponsorship, it works. Because there wasn't one bit of that I had to go through by myself. In fact, the first time that Aaron went to like big boy jail or whatever, a friend of mine called me and said, when are you going to see him? And I told her, and she goes, all right, well, I'm going to come by and pick you up. And I'm like, I didn't even know why she was offering to do that. I was like, no, you know, you don't need to do that. And she's like, no, I want to go with you. Just tell me the day and time. And so I did. And I went back and saw him. And Aaron and I sat there with the plexiglass in front of us. And neither one of us said a word. We both sat there sobbing the whole time. And see, she knew that I was going to need somebody to drive me home. Right? So that's the stuff we do for each other. I mean, you know, somebody asked, hell, I'd have come up here tonight if Blessing said, hey, man, can you come up and after the meeting empty our trash? Because, again, people have done whatever it took to help me to get through something and to know that I wasn't alone. And so I don't know. I may get into a little bit more about that or maybe not. But so, again, I have that understanding of, wow, how selfish and self-centered can I be to think this doesn't affect anybody else but me? It wasn't long after that that I decided to go back to my parents. Like I said, some friends were getting into some pretty serious trouble, and I was afraid that I might kind of follow suit. And so I remember when I was going to move back in with them, here's a thought I had. If I'm going to live with them, I cannot drink. I didn't think to myself, now keep in mind, I don't know what alcoholism is, right? I don't know. But I don't think to myself, man, you know, you got to back up off the drinking at your parents' house. I mean, you're just going to have to. That didn't even occur to me. What occurred to me was, is I can't drink and live here. And I didn't for 30 days. It was the longest, most miserable 30 days of my ever-loving existence. I mean, it was just like, I'm hanging out in the bars with my friends, and they're drinking, and they're all even patting me on the back about how proud they are of me for not drinking as they're drinking. And I'm just getting madder by the day. And so finally, I said to heck with it. A friend of mine, I went to go help her move, and she said, let's have one drink. And I did. And I tell you this because this is, honest to God, the only one time that I really meant to have one. I mean, like, this is it, right? But that's what I thought. I'm just going to have one, and then we'll move her stuff or whatever. To this moment in time, I have never moved that girl. I mean, like, I don't even know what happened, really. What I remember is coming to in my car. I was on the side of the road. I was facing the wrong way for the side of the road I'm on. And here's my first awareness. Crap, I spilled my drink. That's my first, like, that's the thing, right? I don't know about here. Bigger in Texas, we drank out of like plastic tumblers. I swear, y'all might look at it like a pitcher, but it was like a big glass that went between my legs, and I had a standard shift car, so clutching, and you know, it was challenging and fun. I mean, it's what made driving so much fun. And so I'm like, oh my God, I don't, my drink. And then the next thing that occurs to me, oh crap, do I have any money? Because there is a, like, I have to get another drink that is driving me. It's driving me to check under every floor mat. It's driving me to check in between the seats to find enough change to go get the drink. You know, in Doctor's Opinion, it talks about this phenomenon of craving. And I didn't know anything about that before I got to you. Bring about that sense of ease and comfort. I swear, every moment to this day that I sit down and go through that part with somebody in the book, I breathe. Like, I catch a breath, like, from down here, my gut, right? Just, because that's what it does for me. And I'm telling you, that came about as a result of finding enough change. So, like, I found enough change to get the next drink, right? Okay, now I can breathe. I came out of the blackout twice more. Couldn't tell you where that was. All I know is that after that day and for the next 30 days until I, next 6 weeks until I got to you, I would not draw a sober breath. Like, I wasn't even caring that my parents knew. Like, I'm in the pits for that to happen, believe me. And I don't even care. And I got my second DWI. And I got put in jail there in Morris County. Turns out that, like, I didn't know much about the justice system, but turns out there'd been a lot of people kind of looking for me because evidently I was supposed to go see a probation officer or something, whatever that was, for the first one that I got. So they pulled me and took me in here, it's like, oh, we found her. Like, we've been looking for you. And I'm like, didn't know. And so, you know, but this is smack in that little town I grew up in, right? I mean, just like, there's no way that that's not going by 6:30 the next morning at the beauty shops, man. I mean, like, the lines are burning up. And I don't know exactly what happened, but my mom drove me to school. She thought I was still attending school. That might have been because I actually drove an hour to where I was supposed to be going to school. And she drove me on that Monday, and when I got there, I said, I can't get out of the car. And I didn't even know what was happening to me. I'm like, I can't get out of the car, because if I get out of the car, I'm going to drink. And my head is hollering and screaming, what are you doing? Get out of the car. Get out of the car. If I get out of the car, I'm going to drink. And my mom goes, but you don't have any money. Oh, Mom, geez, we hadn't needed none of that in a long time, right? I mean, it's like, I'm sorry, but I didn't say that, but that's just kind of what's going on in my head. And she drove us to a phone booth, plexiglass, metal, it's got a phone in it. They used to even have a phone book in them. This is shocking, I know. And so we went, and she gets out, and I guess she looks under maybe like pee. Psychologist, psychiatrist, I don't know what, but she called him and we drove straight there. And then by 6 o'clock that night, I was in PNS Hospital in Shreveport, Louisiana, in their detox ward. Now, my mom made that call at like 8, but I didn't get to Shreveport until 6. You know why? We had to go shopping because I had to look good in treatment. You know, my mom, you know, this is Betty and Jess Wilson's daughter coming to treatment, and you got to look good, you know. And so I'm telling you, like, I got a whole new wardrobe, including dresses and slips. I swear, okay, I may talk to me afterwards if you don't know what a slip is, okay? Here was the requirements. She asked the treatment center, how many group, like family group things do you have? You know, like were other people's families, not that we're just going to be coming, but everybody else's families or whatever. And I think they said like four dresses and pantyhose and a slip and heels. And that's not the shocking part. The shocking part to me is that I wore them. I mean, like, I got my slip, my dresses and my hose and my heels on for group family things or whatever. I stayed there for 30 days actually, treatment was a blast for me. I mean, like, I do well in treatment. I mean, I just thrived, and everybody's like, oh my God, you're gonna be such a great counselor one day. And I'm like, I know, I've been doing it my whole life anyway. And I mean, it was just fantastic. I'm just oblivious, right? Really, we call it delusion, which means that I literally have false beliefs. It's not like denial where I'm thinking, oh, maybe that's the case. Oh, no. No, it's not. It's not. No, this is where you actually believe what you're thinking, right? Like, I know no different. And so I leave there after 30 days, graduated with my little coin, and then I went to a halfway house. A bunch of women, didn't care for that a whole lot. But I did that for a couple of months or whatever. But when I was in treatment, there were people that came to our treatment center, ironically, every Friday night. And the four that were there when I was there, they were all from the same home group. And the impact that they had on me, and this is like without, I didn't even really have conversations with these people. But I asked where they went to meetings. So the impact that they had, like even without any major conversations, I wanted to be where they were. I just did. I was 20 years old. The next oldest person that I knew in AA at all for about the next 18 months was 35. And I'm 20 years old, so dang, there were some old people, let me just say. You know, I'm like on my 50s now, and it's terrifying to me. Yeah, you know, you just never want to see yourself that way. But you're like, oh, you've been sober longer than I've been alive. And it's almost just like some payback, right? Because God knows I said that to a lot of people myself when I thought they were maybe trying to tell me what I was doing that was wrong or something and stuff. So it was just... But I thought my life was over, and yet, again, there was just something there that I gravitated towards, right? I wanted whatever it was that you had, and I didn't even know what it was. And you know what was great? I didn't have to know. I got involved. I started dating a guy in treatment. Do not recommend that. He was yellow when I met him. Hepatitis. Tall little skinny banana, right? And so, I mean, we even like dyed our hair the same color in treatment. We went to little matching halfway houses, you know, right next door to each other. And yeah, and so we got married. And the day we got married, we started driving to Smyrna, Georgia. And so I was like, my sponsor told me, look, those people at AA, they don't know you, and they've been staying sober just fine without you. But you need them, so you need to get in, and you need to put your hand out, and you need to, you know, get to know and get involved, be active in service, which is what I did. 6 months later, I was pregnant, and I had that 30-year-old son that I have now. But when I was 6 weeks pregnant, no, 6 months pregnant, my husband told me that he had started shooting dope again. And forget the love the alcoholic, hate the disease. I don't even know that I had heard that before. All I felt was that you had done this to me. And so our marriage was over that day, even though I didn't say anything until my son was about 6 months old. Look, I have had great sponsorship in this program. Doesn't mean I have always done what they recommended that I do. But I've always had people that just shot really straight with me. And I think it was almost necessary because I needed to respect them, right? I needed to feel like that I couldn't pull something over on them. And so that just happens to be, much to my chagrin sometimes, the kind of people that I gravitated towards. And I had worked some steps, but things just kind of started going backwards for me a little bit, and I went through a period of a few years where I got up every day, and every morning when I woke up, I was just so disappointed that I was awake, right? Because I just don't want to be here, but I don't feel like I can like kill myself. I mean, oh my gosh. I mean, God just really hates that. So I, what am I going to do? And just this is what I'm living in. And I'm going to meetings every single day. And I am like dying, go in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was 15 in that little small town in Dangerfield, Texas, a guy came in to the church and he started shooting and he killed like, I think it was like seven people, maybe five people that day. Tons of other ones were wounded. But one of them that got shot and killed that day was a seven-year-old little girl named Gina Lynham that I had babysat her and her brothers and sisters the summer before that. So it kind of felt like it was my kid. And it wasn't that happened that caused me to have a problem with God. I don't think I mentioned it, but let me tell you, we were in church a lot, like so much, right? Just y'all probably, some of y'all probably have that in common in the South or whatever. We were there all the time. But it wasn't that. It was about, I don't know, God, 23 months, I think, after all of that happened, that he came back to town because they were getting ready to start the trial. And a lady was going to see him every day. And one day she came out and said, "Woo, praise God, he's been saved and he's going to heaven." If what she said had happened, based on what I had been taught growing up, then he would be in heaven. And it just seemed, I cannot even fathom the fact that this great God would let this guy in heaven where I knew Gina was. Like, I couldn't get there. One of my favorite chapters in our books is We Agnostics, because it, golly, there is so much amazing stuff in there, but at the end of the day, it talks about how, you know, I can't bring these things about. In fact, one of the things that's going to hurt me in that relationship with God is this brain of mine, right? Logic. Like, I'm trying to figure out who and what God is somehow before I decide if I'm going to have some sort of a relationship with him or whatever. And so it talks about how, man, we're in that boat like out on the water and we want to get to shore, right? I want to get to the shore so that I know that faith, but I can't get there. And I was unable at that time to get there. In fact, then I didn't even want to get there, because if that's how it really was, screw you, God. And that's kind of where I stayed even after I came into AA. You know, the group of drunks was a fantastic God for me. And good orderly direction was a fantastic God for me. But eventually the day will come, and I am not saying not to use those things, because I'm telling you those things saved my life until I finally got to the place that God knew that it had to come down to me and him. And that came about as a result of that gift of desperation. Like, I am on my floor, like just writhing. I am in so much pain because it's like the group's not working anymore or whatever's happening. And I uttered these words at 5.5 years sober. I said, "God, just please help me." And he did. He did. A lot of things started changing really quickly. And it was fantastic. And I met another guy. He pulled into Rebo's parking lot with a Texas plate. Oh, thank you, Jesus. This is my reward. This is my reward. Woo! You rock, God. I want to just point out, in the big book and in the 12 and 12, in step 11, it says, "Now look, this whole having a relationship with God, that's going to be like a little new thing. And you need to be really careful and talking to your sponsor, because you're going to start thinking things that you think's from God and they're not." So, you know, you need to still be checking things out with me, your sponsor, about that or whatever. I did not check this out with my sponsor, not one little bit. I mean, I'm somebody that kind of would go easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. And let me just say to you young people, hate all of you because, back then, like now, you can live with your boyfriend and you don't even have to tell your sponsor, right? Because she's going to call your cell phone. Like, you're like, hey, call me. She's going to call cell phone. No, we had landlines. So the only way that I could get my sponsor to call me back was to tell her what number that I'm at. And if it's not mine for a considerable period of time, she has figured out that I have hung curtains with somebody else again, right? So just count your blessings, will you? You know, oh my God. I told her, I said, I'm doing so much different this time, though. I said, I still have my apartment. She said, no, what you have is a very expensive storage building. That's what you have. So, you know, because all my stuff was still over there except for the things I needed on a day-to-day basis. We married 6 months. We meet each other 6 months later. I married. I leave Georgia, and 6.5 years this happened, went on. In the meantime, I moved to Dallas-Fort Worth, and I got my sponsor, Naomi. That I had for 23 years. God used that woman to save my ever-loving life. But it was like, here's a short version of what happened. He didn't work much. And so me, my son, and him ended up living in a tent. I am almost 10 years sober. And needless to say, thank God there were still payphones, right? Because, I mean, I got no cell phone. We ain't into that all those yet really much either. And so I'm out at the tent. I'm living in a tent for like 6 weeks. I got girls that I sponsored because I told myself, I said, God, I gotta let these girls go. This is ridiculous. I can't be sponsoring somebody living at the tent. And she was like, she's like, you are not calling and telling them that you're not sponsoring them anymore. She's like, they may decide that on their own. But it's not going to be because you said I can't be your sponsor anymore. And you know what? I did lose some of them. But there's nothing better than the brand new person. Because here's how that goes. I had a pager, so they were to page me. I had to have change for the payphone. After that first call, I realized two things. I needed a lawn chair and an umbrella in case it starts raining. Because you got that brand new person going, oh my God, my boyfriend just called me an ugly word. They would say the ugly word. The ugly word or whatever. And I'm literally just standing. There's no, hey, how's it going at the tent? I mean, like, there's none of that, right? Because the new person, man, they don't care about you at all. I mean, everything is about them. And it's the most beautiful thing to have when you're going through a hard time. I'm telling you, there ain't nothing like it. And so, Bill, oh, my boyfriend. And I'm just thinking, yeah, but he called you a bad name under, like, a real roof. This is what's happening in my head. Like I'm just sitting there, like, You stink, man, you know. I mean, I take that name calling. Heck, I've dealt with that name calling. If it was, like, not under canvas, you know. I am here to tell you right now that, like, if something happened and I had to go back to camping for a while, I have got me a 3-room condo tent, all right? I mean, like, I have moved up in this world, and I got, an air mattress that's really tall. You could sit on it like a bed. Dang, man, I could live there for a really long time. I was there for 6 weeks, and here's the truth of the matter. At the end of the day, I took one more action based in self, and it says this in step, I think it's in step three of our book, I made a decision, one more decision based on self that later put me in a position to be hurt. Plain and simple. He ended up having an affair with one of the girls that I sponsored. She was living in my house. I wasn't mentioned about having somebody in my house. Thank God that I didn't walk away from any of that, with it keeping me from still opening up my heart, my home, whatever's needed to help somebody else. Our book's very clear that we need to know why and how we're doing something, but sometimes it's called for. And That affair turned out to be the very best thing that ever happened to me in my life. Now, at the moment, I wanted to kill people, right? I mean, I just wanted them dead. And I mean, I was just so angry. But the truth was, I was so hurt. Not even so much by him, but the girl that I sponsored. And would you, 3 months later, she asked me if I would sponsor her again. And I, left to my own devices, I would have. I loved this girl. I loved her so much. And I thought, God, I'm not sure if anybody else can get through to her or whatever like I can. And I called my sponsor, and so I'm telling her what all's happened or whatever. And she said, okay, Tracy, two things. She had an affair with your husband, so she does not get to have you as a sponsor. I don't care how long ago it's been and how much you're all over it. That's the first thing. But it was the second thing that I heard most especially. She said, there's going to come a day where you ask her to do something that she's not really going to want to do. And she's going to always have that card. You're just asking me to do that because I slept with your husband. Yeah, it's like you're leaving her with that opening to not take or follow some direction that might would save her life. And a year later, I went to that girl's funeral because she couldn't get sober. And I still love her. I'm almost glad that her pain, she's out of that pain that she was living in day after day. I started working with a sponsor. God, I'm telling you, things started changing drastically. I knew for a fact that if I did what I had always done in the area of relationships, I would drink again. I knew it. Didn't matter that I was sober for 12 years, I would have drank again. Because all of that harm that I think, oh, I'm just putting myself in, I'm dragging that six-month-old baby through all of this. All of it. And not one time did I have the thought, oh my God, I'm harming him. To this day, every time I sit down with somebody and I go through the third step stuff, that selfishness, self-centeredness, self-propulsion, all those self words, I sit there and I listen to what, you know, their experiences that they're telling me. And there's not a moment that every time that it doesn't go through my head, oh my God. God, it is still unreal to me that I didn't know, right? I don't know that I'm hurting him in that kind of a way. And so let me tell you something, mom's guilt, it runs deep. It runs really, really deep. And if not for these steps, I think I have to take different actions with my son. I think I have to go bail him out of jail. I think I might have to do everything in my power to help him, even if that meant the ruin of my family, because after all, it's my fault, right? If he's there, it's because of me. And I'm so grateful because I think that that kind of love for me would have killed my son, killed him. So again, man, the power that's in these steps, the power that is in complete honesty with a sponsor. 10 years of research I did. I haven't had a drink since I got to you. But for 10 years solid, anybody went out, I went up to them after the meeting and asked them what they were doing. There's only one thing that came out of every single person's mouth. I said, were you being honest with somebody? They said no. You know, while I may not have always done right that moment what my sponsor told me, I was honest with her. Hey, just wanted to let you know, I saw my ex-boyfriend out with this hot model just one day after he broke up with me. Oh, and by the way, slit his tires. Love you, bye. You know, just... I wasn't looking for no direction, right? I mean, I clocked my sister-in-law on her chin and watched her crumple to the ground, and I called and told what I had done, and I said, and if you thinking I'm feeling bad, uh-uh. like, no, not at all. In fact, I'm a little embarrassed to say, I'm not sure that I ever have really felt totally embarrassed by that. But again, you know, it's just... I didn't always do what was asked. Sometimes I didn't even maybe give them a chance to tell me anything. But at the same time, I was always honest. And I think it's the thing that allowed me to stay, no matter how many mistakes that I made. My parents, again, that family that had just been there all the time, you know, Shreveport, Louisiana, and actually East Texas to here, it's 600, my driveway in Smyrna and my parents' driveway, 636 miles. I know this because it's identical to the amount of miles across the state of Texas, 636. And yet every year my parents drove that 636 miles to come here to watch me pick up a chip. Every single year they came until my 8th. They came for my 8th, and that would be the last one until my 15th, because I'm with that guy that just, I'm living in a tent, all that, and he's yelling and calling my mom a bitch. Like, I'm like, I don't even know what to do with that. And my dad says, look, we're just not going to come back for any more of your birthdays. And at first I'm thinking, you selfish, golly, you know, just, it's not comfortable for y'all, so you're just not going to come. And then he said, because we think it'll be easier on you. I don't know how much of that I bought right that moment, but I would come to know its truth. I was involved in service work. I was a GSR for my group. I was at an area assembly. Service work pays people, let me just tell you, because I met my third and last husband. He was serving coffee with his sponsor at the area assembly, and we just did whatever we did, pulling each other's hair, because we don't know how to date, obviously, at all. It was like a couple of weeks or so, and he said, look, I'd really like to call him and invite you out, would that be okay? And I said yes, and then I did something I'd never done. I called my sponsor. I'm like, hey, what do you think? And she said, yeah, I think so, but, you know, there's a few things. There's always a few things. And she goes, no hugging, kissing, no nothing for 6 months. Dang, man, like, whoo. I mean, I know I've had some trouble, but, you know, that's a little drastic. And she said, it took her telling me after 5 years of sobriety, if you don't follow my directions in this, you'll have to get another sponsor. I'm not saying that that's the piece that's called for every time, but by God, she had done enough to earn my trust and respect. And so she asked for it. And I did what she said. And I'm telling you, this coming April will be 20 years that we've been married. And I mean, although my husband, he started getting sober. He started getting excited about our anniversaries. I think when we got to like year 8, he's like, woo, I've been married longer now than the first two marriages combined, you know. So he was always happy about that. The piece that I was happy about was that it's, you know, I always used to say it's easy to love people. But liking them is an entirely different ballgame. And we did go through some serious times. I'm telling you, my dad fell off the roof of his house. I want to tell you, I made the call to them and asked them to come to my 15th birthday, and they hadn't been to one since 8, and they were tickled to come, and they did. And my dad came up to me after the meeting, and he put his arms around me, and he told me how proud he was of me. And I'm telling you, like I wanted that so bad. I can't even tell you. But when I was trying to take actions for him to say that, I was failing miserably. right? Because I'm still making it about me, and it shouldn't have been. You know, it's about, man, if I just be the best version of me that you taught me how to be, to practice these principles in all of my affairs, that's the thing, right? Step 6 in the 12 and 12 says that this is the step that separates the men from the boys. I didn't know for years what the difference was, because you would have had to read the entire chapter to get there. You know, I'm a great starter, you know, but I don't close things out very well. But it says back there, the difference between the boys and the men is the self-determined objective versus the perfect objective of God. One more time, I'm still trying to run the show. And he came and he told me that he was so proud of me or whatever. And I mean, I stood there and I cried, but the gift was I didn't have to have it anymore. It was great, it was the cherry on top, but man, I had been okay with me and my dad for a long time prior to that. And so they came. And the 15th, they came, and the following September, he would fall off the roof of his house, and he would become a brain injury patient, and my mom took the most fantastic care of him for 5.5 years. And then he died. And the gift for me was that mom, ugh, moms, and I'm going to start a card. I'm pretty certain if somebody wants to get with me afterwards, I want to start like a card collection for like alcoholic women, their cards for your mom. You know, the ones that aren't going, oh, my mother, my friend, and you know, oh, you've always been there for me. You know what I mean? It's like, where's this super generic? Like, happy birthday. Happy Mother's Day. That's about all. Like none of that other stuff or whatever. And the gift of him falling, he was in the hospital for 6 months. Guess what? Me and my mom, we sat in that room for hours upon hours. And I got to know her. And I got to come to love her in a way that I would have never thought possible. I'm telling you, I know it's time. I try to pay attention to the clock back there. Like I said, I can't wait to go see her. My mom is still my mom, right? Like, so if I haven't called in like a certain few days, this is how my mother's communication goes. Hey, are you okay? Is everything all right? And I'm like, yeah, mom. Hey, how are you? No. I just need to be sure you are okay. Later we come to know that's like mom code for dang, you hadn't picked up the phone to me, you know, most recent enough, and you can't call her back on the same day because she goes, oh, no, that's okay, I just want to be sure you're all right, and like, but then the next day you can call, and then she's like, oh, hey, how are you? I mean, it's this game that we play, but you know what, I don't even care, because I got the rules to the game, right? And I'm totally fine with those rules because it allows me to just love her right where she is. Right? The hugest gift. I've got a 13-year-old daughter that I have with my husband now, and it's remarkable. I didn't think God would ever want me to have a girl. We didn't find out ahead of time, and they said a girl, and I said, what? Like, I just knew that God knew I was better with boys, whether that's marrying them, friends with them, whatever. And I got a girl, and I was terrified a little bit because I thought, oh, my God, from, like, 11 to, like, 45, she's just going to hate me, you know. And it takes a sponsor in AA to go, doesn't have to be that way. You know, I'm like, oh, really? I mean, last year she told her doctor she didn't know what pot was. I'm like, oh, my God, like it was, Doug called me. He's like, you're not going to believe it. She didn't even still know what pot is. Like, and she's bad at lying, like my son. It was just like this child, we're still going to have problems. I don't know what degree. I used to joke and say, yeah, we'll save my seat, a seat in here for my son. And when that day came, some of the hardest stuff I ever went through. So I don't want to savor a seat, at least not in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. She wants a seat in Al-Anon, then that's fantastic, and I'll support whatever that is. But if nothing else, like, again, trials, tribulations, and you know why? Because that's life. It's just life. I don't get to come in here and everything is just great. It's just not how it works, because life's hard at times. But what I do know is that you come in here and you're willing to, like, connect. You're willing to plug in to us, right? Because my sobriety is more dependent on what I do with you outside of these rooms than anything that we do in here. Because AA is not a place that I go. It is a life that I live. And the more I'm connected to you, then the more in the middle of this thing that I am. And so that way, no matter what happens, I am never walking through 1 ounce of it alone. Unless I choose to. And today, I don't. Today, I choose to stay connected, to be a part of. Because if nothing else, the responsibility that I feel of somebody that's been given the gifts that I absolutely did not deserve, it is my job to make sure that I'm standing right here for you to come plug into me when you're ready. That's my job. That thing I was so angry about with God, about the guy and him possibly going to heaven. If he did, then it's called grace, right? What is God's grace? Grace of any sort is a free gift. I don't deserve anything that I have. And thank God it is not about that. It's just about me allowing God to give me what he wants me to have. And I'm telling you, it's some of the best stuff I've ever gotten. Thank you.
I told you she was going to be good. Thank you so much, Tracy.